Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the September 24th reading of the environment. My name is John. Today, we'll share the following main articles from the Nature Conservancy magazine, Protecting the Heart of Canyon Country. Rancher Heidi Redd tells of her 50-year fight to save one of the most iconic landscapes in the U.S. West. Also, this time from the magazine of the Sierra Club, Swift Foxes Go West. North America's smallest fox has started to show up in places no one expected. Any remaining time we'll fill in with an article from Mother Earth News. So back to our first main article, Protecting the Heart of Canyon Country. This was written by Larissa Bowen. For more than half a century, Heidi Redd has worked to protect the Dugout Ranch, a 5,200-acre oasis on the southern edge of Canyonlands National Park in Utah. The ranch is also the largest private inholding in Bears Ears National Monument and protects more than 353,000 acres of grazing allotments on surrounding federal lands. In the 1990s, financial challenges forced the Redd family to look into selling the ranch, and developers rushed forward with plans to carve this one-of-a-kind landscape into vacation ranchettes, condos, and golf courses. That's when Heidi Redd turned to the Nature Conservancy. The Nature Conservancy purchased the land, providing Redd a lifetime lease on her 25-acre homestead and forever protecting the ranch. But Redd's conservation journey did not end there. As she reflects in this excerpt from her recently published award-winning memoir, many of the challenges facing this historic landscape had just begun. Excerpt from A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch by Heidi Redd with Larissa Bowen. In the Nature Conservancy, I felt like I had found a partner powerful enough to hold the dam from breaking. Around me, pressures were mounting, threatening the land and our way of life. The Nature Conservancy's 1997 purchase of the ranch created an instant buffer, one that became increasingly vital as I watched the region morph. The Colorado Plateau was emerging on people's radars as never before. With five of the country's fastest-growing cities ringing the region, competing demands for resources, especially water and energy, escalated rapidly, as did tourism and recreation. Spanning mostly federal land, the plateau boasts some of America's most popular parks and recreation areas. Millions of visitors began to flood this area each year to bike the slick rock, hike the twisting slot canyons, raft the whitewater, and connect to a place of rare natural beauty. At this point in the story, there's a photograph of the author in a denim shirt with a red bandana around the neck, a cowboy hat, and braided hair, standing in a corral, and it's captioned, "Partner in Conservation." Rancher Heidi Redd has lived at the Dugout Ranch in southeast Utah for more than 50 years. In 1997, she teamed up with the Nature Conservancy to protect the 5,200-acre property, which also controls more than 353,000 acres of grazing allotments on surrounding federal lands. The article continues, "Of course, I understood the magnetic pull here, but I began to wonder how the region could support and balance the onslaught of these interests. I shuddered as I recalled a real estate agent sizing up the Dugout's pastures. On the morning of the Nature Conservancy's celebration for the purchase of the Dugout, I floated on a cloud of relief. I remember riding my horse toward the big tent we'd set up near headquarters to welcome all of the supporters and community guests. As I crossed the pasture, I gazed up at the sundial and the watchdog, the two singular red rock formations that hover over the ranch valley, poised like primordial guardians. But as TNC staff and I would soon realize, the fight to save the Dugout was not over. The greatest threat was just emerging, and it would not be stopped by a property boundary. As climate change began to crystallize in America's consciousness, the Dugout slowly took on a new role as a providing ground for scientists and ranchers studying climate impacts, and its fate became tied to the destiny of the entire Colorado Plateau. Here's another photograph of Heidi Red leading a unbridled, unsaddled horse with the picture of those two buttes in the background, and it's captioned Red Rock Sentinel. Soaring cliffs encircle the Nature Conservancy's Dugout Ranch, which is also surrounded by federal lands, including Canyonlands National Park and Bears Ears National Monument. The article continues, "For years, I'd ridden past the weather instrument set up by the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, on the grazing allotments on federal lands near ranch headquarters. They emerged from the pasture grass like lonely metal skeletons. I always wondered what the scientists were learning and why they'd chosen that spot. What I did not realize at the time was that the dugout lies along the southwestern monsoonal boundary, making it particularly sensitive to climatic variation. Scientists affiliated with government agencies had gathered decades of valuable data from those instruments, amassing a treasure trove of information and creating a powerful tool for anyone who wanted to understand what climate change would mean for the Colorado Plateau. By 2008, reports were widespread that the American West had warmed 70% more than the planet as a whole, and that those of us here in the Colorado River Basin were in the bullseye for future problems, including prolonged droughts and increasing heat. The unknowns were mounting. How would the region respond to climate change? How would the many different land uses here affect the resilience of our resources? How would ranchers survive? How should we adapt? Public land managers, communities, agricultural producers, and lawmakers needed answers, and we needed some way to prepare or respond. That's where the dugout came into play. The Nature Conservancy realized it had protected the perfect laboratory to study climate change and land use right in the heart of the Colorado Plateau. In addition to being the site of more than 20 years of climate and weather data accrued by the USGS, the dugout was a working ranch with its own cattle herd, and it was situated next to more than 350,000 acres of public grazing allotments, as well as the acres protected within Canyonlands National Park. For decades, these public lands had been managed for different uses by the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and the National Park Service. Some of the acres had been grazed or open to recreation. Some had little human impact. So scientists had ideal control sites for testing and comparison. Dugout also had something even more important, people. Nobody builds bridges like the Nature Conservancy. Utah State Director Dave Livermore and Conservation Director Chris Montag at the Nature Conservancy's Utah Chapter Helm in Salt Lake City were joined by Sue Bellagamba, a vigorous young conservationist who lived in Moab and was leading the Nature Conservancy's work in the Canyonlands region. Dave, Chris, and Sue worked hard to form positive relationships within the local field station managers and scientists at the agencies overseeing the public grazing allotments. They began to share data and brainstorm ideas. TNC also connected with professors and researchers, especially at Utah State University. A group of us started meeting regularly at the dugout, talking about the dire climate change predictions, soil and grass health, ranching, recreation, and the region's future. Everyone saw a crisis brewing on the plateau, and they also saw the potential of what we had, the right place, the right data, and the right partners. In 2010, the Nature Conservancy launched the Canyonlands Research Center, known as CRC, with its base at the dugout. The program's founding partners were TNC, the USGS, and the USDA Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, Utah State University, and the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. The Nature Conservancy converted a portion of a dugout barn into a lab and classroom space and built an open-air pavilion as well as a small tent cabin camp for visiting scientists. The CRC's research takes place in a unique outdoor laboratory where top scientists from around the world come here to study climate change, biological soil crusts, rangeland management, dryland vegetation, ecology, and much, much more. The ideas, tools, and strategies coming out of the CRC are meant to help ranchers, public land managers, and communities in arid lands withstand climate change. Here's another photograph of the author on horseback herding a bunch of cattle, and it's captioned, "Rounding Up." Once a year, Red and her crew round up cattle from the high mountain meadows and bring them down to the range near the ranch. The ranch is piloting the use of drought-tolerant cattle breeds and other techniques to help Western ranchers in the face of a hotter and drier climate. The article continues, "Truth be told, I get excited about a lot of the projects going on here. One example is the large-scale restoration of biocrust, which could impact the health of drylands worldwide. Known as a living skin, biocrusts are organisms on top of the soil that look like a craggy, charred carpet stretching between shrubs and grasses on the desert floor. This unassuming ground cover plays a vital role in the health of the entire desert ecosystem, benefiting soil, vegetation, and preventing the dust storms that contribute to air pollution." The CRC's reputation grew quickly. Amid the surge of new ideas and new people at the ranch, I recognized it was time for my role to shift. In 2015, I officially retired from running the cattle operation, and the Nature Conservancy hired my son Matt and his wife Kristen. As project director for the CRC, Matt runs the Dugout Ranch and cattle operation and directs the ranch coordination with the scientists. Kristen is head of outreach and education programs at the CRC and builds valuable collaborations with partners, students, local tribes, scientists, and artists. As heat and drought intensify, ranchers in the Southwest are the ones with skin in the game. They have serious motivations to safeguard the health of the lands that sustain their families, and most of them are also lifelong students of the ranching trade, eager to adapt and innovate. Matt leads some of the CRC's most interesting research initiatives. They're using GPS collars and other technology to experiment with a new breed of cattle, the Rarámuri Criollo. Descended from Spanish cattle first brought to Mexico centuries ago, Criollo are smaller than Red Angus, and they are hardier, ranging farther for forage and able to travel long distances for water. Matt and his team are seeking important answers. Will the Criollo flourish here on the Colorado Plateau, and do they have a smaller environmental impact on the range? If scientists prove that they can, and they do, ranchers in the Southwest could have a new, powerful tool in the fight to remain in business as the climate shifts. From the very start of the CRC, when I first began interacting with the scientists, I realized that ranchers like me and Matt can make valuable contributions to their research mission. There's a deep knowledge of this landscape stored in my brain and in my bones, one embedded over decades of riding the range, sleeping under the stars, and observing the life and natural patterns of this place. It's a knowledge fueled by having to feed and sustain livestock year after year, relying on these grasses, moving through these canyons, tracking the rain and snowfall, and worrying about flows from the creeks. I know and see things in the dugout country that the scientists, even with their sophisticated instruments, do not. So I found, to my delight over the years, that the PhDs and I enjoyed learning from each other, and in the race against climate change, we truly need each other. One night, maybe 5 years after the CRC had launched, I found myself sitting across the table from Nicole Barger, a University of Colorado professor and arid lands ecologist, and now deputy chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy. Nicole was directing the CRC's research at the time. It was late, and Nicole was tired. She'd spent all day out on the range, working with her grad students to monitor the vegetation study plots they had erected. We'd spent an hour talking about the changes I saw in the warm and cool season grass species, as she asked when and why I'd made certain management decisions over the years. It was the kind of conversation in which the common ground between us, scientist and rancher, was palpable. As I handed her a cold bottle of Coke, she smiled gratefully. "I love that you are here talking with us," she said. "This is how science should always be done. How many of us get to work alongside someone who has observed and lived off the land for 50 years? I chuckled, but before I could respond, she leaned forward and nodded to a group of her young graduate students eating at a nearby table. Two women and a man in their early 20s, t-shirts smeared with red dirt from their fieldwork. Their laughter spiraled upwards, lifting on the evening breeze. "Seriously, Heidi, these kids spend an hour with you, and it forever changes their view of ranchers and their understanding of who cares about conservation and why." That night, crawling into bed, I gazed out my open window at the face of the Sundial Rock Formation, ghostly and solemn in the moonlight, and I thought about what Nicole said. All these years, I'd never questioned my calling. My heart and soul had been fulfilled by this land and by my work with the cattle. Now, to my surprise, I found a new purpose. My desperate fight to save the dugout had led me to the Nature Conservancy, but its protection was just one step in the journey. The dugout, the Nature Conservancy, and I, and now my family and many other partners, are on a much longer road together, one fraught with greater perils than I'd ever imagined. But as I pictured Nicole and her grad students at the CRC Pavilion, and Matt working with scientists and running cattle, and Kristen meeting with tribal students, I smiled. Hope truly is about being part of something greater than yourself, and it's about realizing that you are not alone. Climate change is here, and it's a grievous threat to all of us. But thanks to the Nature Conservancy and all the CRC partners, the dugout and I are not complacent. I will always be a cowgirl, but now I'm a cowgirl with a mission and a vision for leaving a legacy that matters not just to me or my family, but to ranchers and communities everywhere eking out their livings across all the arid lands of this earth. And a footnote to the article, excerpted with edits from A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey, Stories from the Dugout Ranch by Heidi Redd with Larissa Bowen. The book won the Western Writers of America 2025 Spur Award for Best Western New Nonfiction. To order a copy of the book, go to nature.org/UtahCowgirl. Our next article comes to us from the magazine of the Sierra Club. It's titled, Swift Foxes Go West. North America's smallest fox has started to show up in places no one expected. Written by Ian Rose. The article opens up with a photograph of three fox pups playing around. Of course, they're cuter than you can imagine. And it's captioned, Swift Fox Pups Play in the Pawnee National Grassland in Colorado. The article begins. In the summer of 1805, more than a year into their expedition to survey the new western territory of the United States, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark encountered an animal new to western science, the swift fox. It's the smallest and, true to its name, fastest North American canid. There is a remarkable small fox which associates in large communities and burrows in the prairies, Lewis wrote in his journal as the party waited for storms to pass. They are extremely watchful and take refuge in their burrows, which are very deep. In the centuries of explosive American expansion that followed, the foxes, like so much other wildlife, found their habitat decimated. Settlers, seeking their own piece of the West, converted vast stretches of prairie into farmland. Waves of colonization followed, bringing with it the encroachment of railroad tracks, roads, towns, and eventually cities. Since Lewis, every naturalist and scientist who wrote accounts of swift foxes or studied their movements agreed that they were creatures of the short grass prairies within the Great Plains. The ecosystem stretched from Canada to Texas, and the foxes were believed to live nowhere else. More than two centuries after Lewis and Clark, swift foxes are surprising researchers with how adaptable they can be. They're showing up in completely different habitats, more than 60 miles west of the prairie land that experts agreed was their only home. A few of these early observations came from a student and wildlife enthusiast named Dana Nelson. Nelson first saw a swift fox in western Wyoming in 2017 and has spotted several more in the years since. It just doesn't compute with what you're used to seeing and reading, said Nelson, whose doctoral research at Clemson University focused on the foxes. Every single paper talks about swift foxes needing short-stature grassland and large tracts of prairie. But there they were, in habitats dominated by knee or even waist-high sagebrush. As sightings continued to stream in from the scrublands, they got the attention of wildlife managers at the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. In 2022, they joined scientists from the University of Wyoming and the Bureau of Land Management to track swift foxes in the Bureau of Land Management's Lander Field Office in western Wyoming. They published their results this June in the journal Wildlife Biology. Austin Smith, a research scientist at the University of Wyoming and lead author of the study, was excited to learn more about how a vulnerable species thought to be limited to one habitat could potentially spread to another. It seemed like good news, a rare and precious commodity in 21st century wildlife biology. We're in a world where species decline is evident globally. We're constantly dealing with habitat loss, habitat destruction, disturbances, and you name it, said Smith. Hearing of sensitive species getting any sort of gain, especially in what would be considered an unconventional habitat, would definitely come off as a win, and it could be. But, as Smith and his colleagues' works showed, that win could come with some caveats and complications. Swift foxes are not federally listed as threatened or endangered, but they are listed as a Tier 2 species of greatest conservation need at the state level in Wyoming. That means that the states consider their population relatively stable, but ranks various threats like habitat loss, predators, and human impacts as severe. This, like all management decisions for the foxes made in the last century, was based on an assumption that they were a grassland obligate. It had long been scientific and management dogma that, because of their size and vulnerability to large predators, like coyotes, swift foxes needed the long sightlines that short grass prairie provides. If there were too many trees or shrubs to block that sight, the thinking went, they could be picked off and might not survive and reproduce nearly as well. Along with their own survival, one of the big questions surrounding the scrubland foxes is what effect they could have on species native to that habitat. Research on the westernmost fox's diet is still ongoing, but one new prey item on the menu, said Smith, may be the kangaroo rat, a common and widespread small mammal of Great Plains scrublands. Kangaroo rats are already an important prey species for many other predators, including coyotes, owls, hawks, and snakes. It will take more time and study to know whether a new carnivore on the scene will impact prey species or outcompete existing predators. Meanwhile, Nelson's doctoral work was part of a reintroduction project in Montana that could bring the foxes back to an important corner of their former range. Her team hopes the reintroduction will help researchers understand the long-term effects and potential success of the Wyoming foxes. The Fort Belknap Indian community includes over 7,000 enrolled tribal members. Their 675,000-acre reservation in northern Montana is a small remnant of their ancestral home, which they shared for millennia with species they recognize as relatives. Fort Belknap is one of the rare places where three prairie species, once all but extinct, now roam free: the bison, the black-footed ferret, and as of 2020, the swift fox. That year, a five-year reintroduction program began with the release of 27 foxes on the reservation. It could not have happened without Fort Belknap Indian community's willingness to partner with conservation organizations, said Nelson. The tribal council passed a resolution to start the process, and elders and community members guided the logistical and scientific work, such as deciding on the best sites to release the foxes, as well as the spiritual ceremonies welcoming their relatives back to the land. Species reintroductions are long-term efforts, and the Fort Belknap project is still in its early years. But the early signs are promising, including many dens and newborn kits on the reservation. It also led to several findings that could inform the study of the new population of foxes in western Wyoming scrubland. The foxes being reintroduced to Fort Belknap were taken from four sites, including one in Wyoming's Shirley Basin, which featured more scrub habitat than the others. Nelson and others guessed that the foxes caught there might settle into some of the more scrub-dominated parts of the reservation. But that did not happen. No matter where the foxes came from, they consistently chose the most grass-dominated habitat. Smith sees this as an especially exciting time to study swift foxes, and not just because of the shift into new habitat. New technologies are allowing researchers to gather new insights into the foxes' daily lives. Until recently, the collars and battery packs that Smith's team used to track the foxes were just too big and heavy to load onto such a small animal. It's only been in the last handful of years that we have the technology that we can put a collar on them, said Smith. Swift foxes are the size of a house cat, so you cannot put a lot of weight on them, but the technology is finally there. In addition to lighter tracking equipment, environmental DNA and metabarcoding advances give researchers a new, less invasive way to track fox diet. With these tools, every piece of foxcat is a potential goldmine of prey DNA. Between the new population in western Wyoming, so far successful reintroductions in Montana and elsewhere, and potential increases in habitat in the coming decades, the Swift Fox has the potential to be a conservation success story. But, as both Smith and Nelson pointed out, there are still many questions to be answered and a long way to go before this small, shy fox of the American prairie is out of the proverbial woods. That takes us to the end of our time today. Thank you so much for joining us for the September 24th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.